Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 21st of June, these are our main stories. Politicians from around the world converge on London to discuss how Ukraine will be rebuilt after the war. Beijing hits back after President Biden compared his Chinese counterpart to a dictator. And
they're in a tough situation, and the clock is ticking. According to the company specs and the submarine spec, on Thursday they will probably be out of oxygen.
The hunt for the missing Titanic tourist sub enters a critical stage. Also in this podcast, a BBC investigation reveals the British government sent hundreds of mentally ill people back to the Caribbean. How will Ukraine be rebuilt once the war there is over? That's the question being addressed in London at a two-day meeting of political and business leaders from around the world. In a video message to the Ukraine Recovery Conference, as it's called, President Zelensky urged the gathering to produce practical results.
The eyes of the world are looking at us and at whether we will defeat Russian aggression exactly as freedom deserves to win, that is, without compromising our values. Also, the world is watching to see if we will restore normal life in such a way that our transformation will land an ideological defeat on the aggressor.
The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken told the conference that the United States would continue to support Ukraine.
Every investment that we make in Ukraine's recovery is aimed at bringing Ukrainians closer to that reality. And today, I'm announcing that with the support of the United States Congress, we will provide more than $1.3 billion in additional aid to help Ukraine toward that goal. Russia is causing Ukraine's destruction, and Russia will eventually bear the cost of Ukraine's reconstruction.
The World Bank has put the cost of rebuilding Ukraine at more than $400 billion over the next 10 years, warning that the figure will rise as the war continues. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale is at the conference. First, what does Ukraine want to see from the gathering?
From the Ukrainian point of view, it's a very consistent message. We want more investment. We want it now. Ukraine is reforming. You can trust Ukraine. Ukraine is a good bet. You're not just talking about agriculture, but energy, tech. You know, there's an economic future for the country, but also at the same time saying, look, it's more than just Ukraine's economy at stake here. It's Europe's economy. So that's why the West needs to invest. The message from the other side is slightly different. It is, yes, lots of pledges of money and support, both from the UK, the United States, from Europe, you know, a lot of money, billions of euros, dollars, pounds are being announced today. But the real issue is this: how can the West encourage outside investment, private sector investment, into Ukraine when the war is still raging? Because outside investors are worried about the risk to their employees. They're worried about the risk to whatever they construct and whether it's still vulnerable to Russian attack. And crucially, they are worried about Ukrainian corruption. They do not want to invest to discover that a large chunk of the cash has been expropriated by the wrong people. So that is the reassurance that business is looking for here. So there's lots of creative discussion about war insurance, because at the moment the private insurers simply won't insure businesses to go into a war zone, but also the call, the demand, the need for Ukrainian reform to its institutions, more transparency, more accountability, the growth of the civil society within the country. Ukraine says, we're working on it, we're doing it. The West is saying, you need to do more.
Briefly, James, where's the money going to come from?
the money is going to have to come from the private sector, because if you think about it, as you said in your introduction, it is all coming for the size of the problem is, you know, 300 billion plus pounds just for the cost of last year's destruction alone. No one country can provide that out of state funding. The money has to come from the private sector. There are companies here. There are hundreds of business people here. They all know that in the future, Ukraine will be a huge business opportunity, but they need reassurance.
James Landale. Meanwhile, on the ground in Ukraine, intense fighting is taking place along a number of fronts. The Ukrainian military says it's made gains around Zaporizhia in the south, though President Zelensky has acknowledged that progress has been slower than desired. Our correspondent, Myeni Jones, gave me this update from Kyiv.
The Deputy Defence Minister, Anna Malia, gave an update saying that they're moving forwards in several directions in the south in Zaporizhia, including moving towards the Russian-occupied cities of Melitopol and Berdyansk. It's the main focus of this counteroffensive at the moment. It's where they say that Russia is on the defensive, that its Russian forces are putting up a tough fight. They won't surrender any territory, and so every single battle there is being hardly fought. They've said over the last 8 weeks that they've recovered 8 villages, including the latest one is a small hamlet called Piatehake. But they're also cautioning against measuring the success of this counteroffensive in terms of the number of settlements or kilometres that have been recaptured. They say that it's a much more complex operation than that, that success can be measured. They're measuring success certainly in a variety of different ways that, you know, the main bit of the counteroffensive is still to come. At the moment, they're still making slow and steady progress, pushing forward inch by inch.
You heard President Zelensky, though. It's not going as quickly as perhaps he'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because many people are remembering the autumn of last year when their last counteroffensive happened and they made, you know, great strides in areas like Kharkiv. But this time round, they're saying it's a much more difficult situation. The terrain is different in the south. The Russian forces, because they've known that this counteroffensive has been coming for several months now, have been able to put up a fairly solid defence line, including mining lots of areas. As a matter of fact, Ukrainian authorities are claiming that in Zaporizhia they're even now mining towns and villages that are still inhabited by civilians. So it's a lot tougher to move forward when you're facing a minefield. You can't just kind of run in. You have to move in very slowly. And that's why they say that this counteroffensive is going to be a lot more different.
Briefly, Myeni, reports of drones being shot down over Moscow.
Yeah, the Russian authorities say that they shot down 2 drones this morning, that they were approaching warehouses of a military unit near the town of Narofominsk. They claim that no casualties or damages were made. And just a reminder that the last time that Moscow claimed it was targeted by drones was in late May. At the time, they hit residential buildings, but it didn't cause much damage.
Myeni Jones. Sounds of banging have raised fresh hopes in the search for a submersible that went down to look at the wreck of the Titanic. It's been out of contact since Sunday, but people around the world are clinging to signs of survival for those aboard. Rear Admiral John Mauger of the U.S. Coast Guard outlined the next steps.
As long as there's a opportunity for survival, we will continue to work with this broad unified command to bring every resource to bear on the search. Over the course of the next 24 hours, we're going to bring additional vessels, additional remote operated vehicles, and we're going to continue to fly in the air. So we'll continue to look.
I asked our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos, what we should make of the banging.
Well, it's the best bit of news that we've had, certainly in the last couple of days. We kind of need more information from the authorities to really kind of understand it. But, you know, it could be. There's a lot of caveats here, but it could be potentially some noises coming from the submersible itself. You have to remember that one of the, and I've thought about this, one of the crew members is a very experienced naval officer. P.H. Nagelet was in the French Navy for 20-odd years. So he would know the protocols that you would follow in an instance like this. And if you think about this sub, it's kind of like a cylinder of carbon fiber with titanium ends. So maybe they're banging the metal ends. And if you did it in a distinct pattern at regular intervals, timed intervals.
Every half hour, apparently.
Yeah, maybe. maybe you can then distinguish that noise from the general din of the ocean, right? Because the ocean's a pretty noisy place, but you'd want something specific that they could pull out. Now, they have these sonar buoys on the surface, so the planes have dropped these. If you time the arrival of those noises to the different buoys, then you could potentially get a fix. You know, even if it was hanging mid-water column, you would get ghost reflections that would then arrive later at the sonar buoy. So you might be able to say, actually, it's a little bit higher in the water column. And the suspicion is it might be just on the sea floor. But it's a way of narrowing down that search, because it's a huge amount of sea floor that they're looking at. And obviously, they've got limited time now.
These noises were heard a few hours ago, but yeah, ominously, perhaps, now they're not being detected.
The sensible thing would not be to constantly do it, right? Because then that, you know, is that a propeller? What is it? You know, you would not only time it at intervals to make it stand out, but also you need to conserve energy in that sub. Like I say, it's very cold, we think, if they've lost power. So they've got no heating, no lighting perhaps, a lot of condensation on the walls. It's very uncomfortable in there. So they wouldn't be continually banging on the metal.
Jonathan Amos. Israeli settlers have attacked residents and set fire to olive groves and cars in several Palestinian towns and villages in the occupied West Bank in revenge for the killing of four Israelis on Tuesday. The BBC's Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman is in Jerusalem.
What we've had today is a day of funerals and further violence in the occupied West Bank. Firstly, as you mentioned, in the last few hours, we're getting more reports of attacks by Israeli settlers in Palestinian villages, in particular a village north of Ramallah in the West Bank, where residents are saying that dozens of cars and homes have been attacked and some torched by Israeli settlers. That followed attacks further north in the West Bank, in and around Hawara, as you said last night. The Palestinian Red Crescent saying a child was beaten there, and also reports of a Palestinian journalist who was hit by rocks thrown through the windscreen of his car. So that part of the violence in the territory has been escalating. And that is since yesterday, when four Israelis were killed, shot dead by Palestinian gunmen at a gas station just off the main north-south highway in the West Bank, by two Palestinian gunmen who were killed. The funeral of those four Israelis who came from settlements in the West Bank has taken place today. A 17-year-old, an 18-year-old, a man in his 20s, and a man in his 60s were all killed. Before that, on Monday, that event appeared to be in part sparked by a raid into the city of Jenin by the Israeli military, which killed seven Palestinians, and the seventh died overnight. That was a 15-year-old girl who had her funeral today, carried by fellow students through the streets of Jenin. So we're seeing, you know, casualty rates we haven't seen in a very long time here. And that is all leading in a situation that was already burning in the West Bank to increase fears of further escalation.
Tom Bateman in Jerusalem. China has reacted angrily to comments made by President Biden, likening his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping to dictators. At a news briefing in Beijing, a foreign ministry spokeswoman, Mao Ning, said the comments were provocative and inappropriate.
These remarks are absurd and extremely irresponsible. It is against the basic facts and the diplomatic protocols. It seriously violates China's dignity and amounts to public political provocation. China expresses its strong dissatisfaction and opposition.
Mr. Biden had said that Mr. Xi was angry at not knowing about a Chinese balloon that was shot down over the United States in February. He said Mr. Xi was embarrassed, like all dictators who are unaware of events they would expect to control. The remarks come a day after Mr. Biden praised work by the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, for improving relations with Beijing. I asked our correspondent, Stephen McDonnell, if the progress Mr. Blinken appeared to have made has now been wasted.
Can you imagine he'd be possibly tearing his hair out after going through days of meetings, 7.5 hours long and the like, to try to stabilise Sino-US relations, and now this, one day after he left, we have Joe Biden equating Xi Jinping with other dictators. And of course Beijing was going to respond to this angrily. You wonder if the fiery rhetoric from Beijing is partly separate from their cool analysis, if I could put it that way, because if you listen to what Joe Biden was saying, he actually seemed to be trying to downplay the spy balloon incident. I mean, he was talking about the fact that it wasn't deliberate on the part of China at the time, that Xi Jinping probably didn't even know how it got there or why it was there, when it was there. But then he went on to say, and so dictators like this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and just using that turn of phrase, like here we are again, they're slinging mud at one another.
I mean, was it done deliberately? Because you'd like to think that the US president doesn't do things by accident.
It would have been different if he'd come out and said something like, look, everybody, Xi Jinping is a dictator. Now, sure, it wasn't a great choice of phrase if you want to mend relations with another country, but it also didn't seem as a deliberate provocation. I mean, why would the Americans do that? Why would they go to all the trouble of sending the Secretary of State to Beijing to try to mend relations, to try and stop things from getting worse, only to turn around 24 hours later to attempt to sink that whole process? It just doesn't make sense.
From China's point of view, can the damage be repaired?
If they really want to stabilise this situation, they can just wait it out now and still plan to have a meeting between Joe Biden and Xi Jinping, because that was the idea, possibly later in the year. And by the time we get to October, when this meeting would likely take place, I think most people will have probably forgotten it by then if they don't make too much of it. And so, sure, Beijing had to respond, but it is a fixable situation.
Stephen McDonnell.
Still to come in this podcast.
The situation is terrible. It's indescribable. All the people were forced to flee the city.
People are getting desperate as yet more fighting erupts in Sudan.
Who are the all-time greatest African footballers to play in the Premier League?
There's nothing that boy can't do.
See if your picks made the list on Match of the Day, Africa Top 10.
Let's go.
What?
Incredible.
Coming soon.
We were supposed by now to have seen US intelligence declassified material on the origins of coronavirus. That was due by Monday under a law passed by Congress a few months ago. 2 days on, the information has not emerged. Why? Michelle Hussein asked John Sudworth, former China correspondent, now based in the US and presenter of a BBC podcast on how COVID began, what he thought was going on.
A lot of speculation as to why that might be. Maybe the Secretary of State was in China right as that deadline passed. Maybe it was the sort of optics of that, the politics. It might be to do with, behind-the-scenes wrangling over the protection of sources. Who knows? It hasn't come, but there is a lot of speculation, given that it is a legal requirement, that it will come soon.
Separately, John, what's the latest understanding about whether the virus could have been around before January 2020, given that there's a scientist who worked at that Wuhan Institute of Virology who's now understood to have become ill in late 2019?
Yeah, it's really interesting this, Michelle. I mean, we've known since early 2021 that at least one part of the intelligence picture is said to suggest that there were, in fact, three scientists at the Wuhan Institute of Virology who became sick. Back then, the briefing suggested that the intelligence agencies couldn't tell, though, whether the sickness was just ordinary seasonal flu or COVID. And, of course, that would be highly relevant if they knew that kind of detail. But what's changed in the past few days is there have now been a few US news reports suggesting that the intel was a little more detailed than previously known. Newspapers here publishing the names of those three scientists, at least one of whom is known to have been very closely involved in the coronavirus research that laboratory was doing. So, as you might expect, that has been seized upon by proponents of the lab leak theory as a kind of smoking gun. That said, you have to wonder, if the intelligence really is so detailed, why it is that the kind of broader intelligence assessments have so far been so vague. Out of 18 US intelligence agencies, it's only the FBI and the Energy Department that lean towards a lab leak, and even then only with low to moderate confidence. Clearly, whatever it is that they have and whatever they're going to release, they themselves don't appear to be too excited by it. So it's all a bit of a mystery. We will obviously know more when and if it comes.
John Sudworth, and his podcast is called Fever, The Hunt for COVID's Origin. It's a podcast. 4 episodes are on BBC Sounds already, and 4 more are coming soon. In the years after the Second World War, tens of thousands of people left their homes in the Caribbean to help rebuild what they saw as the mother country. They're often called the Windrush generation, after the ship that brought the first of them. The Britain they came to make a new life in was often cold, grey and unwelcoming. And now, a BBC investigation has revealed that hundreds of long-term sick and mentally ill people from the Windrush generation were sent back into the Caribbean in what's been described as a historic injustice. Former confidential documents reveal that more than 400 people were sent back between the 1950s and the early 1970s under a scheme that was meant to be voluntary. Families say they were ripped apart and some were never reunited. I spoke to our correspondent Navtej Johal about his investigation into this story.
These documents are stored in the National Archives in London, and they are decades old, some of them from the 1950s. And they spell out how this policy of repatriating people from the UK back to Commonwealth countries in the Caribbean worked. And what was supposed to happen is that a patient with a chronic or mental illness was meant to express a wish to return. The doctor would then determine that it would benefit the patient and that there were suitable arrangements in the receiving country. But we've found evidence which suggests the benefit to the patient may not have always been the main concern. One of the most striking examples we came across was a previously unseen letter from 60 years ago from the Jamaican High Commission, in which they say that UK hospital authorities were requesting repatriations largely on the grounds of pressure on beds, giving the impression that this was being done regardless of whether adequate treatment was available. And legal experts have told us that because of the health, particularly the mental health of these patients, it's questionable whether this was actually lawful.
And the effect of this would have been catastrophic, wouldn't it?
Well, we know that families were severely damaged by this policy. I've spoken to 2 daughters of people who were repatriated. In one instance, a young mother was sent back to Jamaica in the 1960s and her daughter was then taken into care. The two didn't meet again for nearly 20 years and their relationship was permanently damaged, she says. And an even more disturbing example is of a man named Joseph Armatrading, who was repatriated to St. Kitts in 1966, whose wife and 5 daughters never saw him again. In his case, we found a letter he wrote to the UK government asking to return to Britain, and internal government letters which show officials made mistakes in his case and that he should have been allowed to return. And I've been speaking to his daughter, June.
How dare they? This was a vulnerable man. You're supposed to look after your vulnerable people. And they didn't. They just left him. They abandoned him and abandoned us at the same time.
Now, in total, we found that more than 400 people with a chronic or mental illness were sent back to Commonwealth countries in the Caribbean. But because of the way records were kept at the time, that number could even be higher.
And this is just the latest heartbreaking chapter in the Windrush story, isn't it?
It is, that's right. Your listeners might remember that the Windrush scandal took place 5 years ago. That's when it emerged. And that was where people who had a right to remain in the UK were threatened with deportation and sometimes even were deported back to the Caribbean. And in that case, it emerged that the UK Home Office had kept no records of those granted permission to stay and had not issued the paperwork they needed to confirm their status. And it had also destroyed landing cards belonging to Windrush migrants in 2010. So in some ways, this story does have echoes of what happened 5 years ago.
Navtej Johal. People living in the Sudanese capital are once again having to endure heavy clashes after fighting erupted between rival military factions in several parts of Khartoum. The violence flared shortly before a 72-hour truce between the army and the paramilitary RSF was due to expire. Our Africa regional editor is Richard Hamilton.
We're getting our information from residents who are still in the capital, and this is the wider Khartoum, which includes the adjoining cities of Bari and Omdurman, which are all on the other side of the Nile, where the confluence of the Nile is. And in Bari, there have been airstrikes, and the RSF, that's the paramilitary, have responded with anti-aircraft fire. There's similar clashes in Omdurman and in Khartoum itself. The Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, accused the army of using a drone to bomb the intelligence headquarters, which has been engulfed in an immense fire since Tuesday night. Then, in terms of sort of propaganda, there's a video of regular army soldiers celebrating around a captured paramilitary armoured vehicle, and that's being paraded on Facebook by the army as an example of how they think they're winning the war. But generally, heavy airstrikes, heavy fighting, the ceasefire over the last few days seems a long way ago now.
Yeah, this conflict has been going on for, what, 2 months now? What's going on elsewhere in the country?
It's not so easy to get information out of Darfur because a lot of the phone lines and internets have been cut and they're remote places anyway. But the BBC has spoken to an activist from Darfur from an area called Tawila. His name is Altaha Hashim, and he said he was almost lost for words in terms of how violent the atrocities have been.
The situation is terrible. It's indescribable. All the people were forced to flee the city, and some of them have left to Jabal Marra, while the others left to Al-Fashir. That's about 60 kilometers walking. It's quite terrible. The situation is indescribable.
And Altaha Hashim actually in the interview became quite angry, and he accused the international community of doing nothing. He said they were standing by and watching while hideous atrocities were being committed. And he said that history was being repeated because there was a terrible genocide 20 years ago in Darfur, and the Janjaweed were accused of human rights violations and war crimes, crimes against humanity. And he feels that the same people who got away with it are now reimposing that sort of havoc and destruction on Darfur all over again.
Richard Hamilton. Now, did you know that Elon Musk just hired a 14-year-old prodigy? Karan Kwasi is set to start work with Musk's SpaceX firm as a software engineer, and this all comes shortly after leaving California's Santa Clara University as the youngest graduate in the school's 172-year history. Well, my colleague James Copnell has been speaking to Karan Kwasi about his lightning-fast trajectory.
For me, it feels very normal. For as long as I can remember, my brain has always worked this way. So it feels very normal for me. I think the logical step in my career.
When you talk about your career, what are you thinking at age 14? Where do you see your career going?
In the future, I either want to be a tech leader at an established company or I want to found a startup in 5 to 10 years. But since that's so far out and technology is so quickly evolving, I really couldn't tell you what I would be doing.
I wonder how other people tend to respond to you as a prodigy, as someone who is obviously younger than the people around you, whether that's at university, now it's going to be in the world of work. How do people react to you?
When I first started both at my community college and at Santa Clara University, there was, I think, a lot of curiosity about my situation. But people very quickly realized that I was just a regular college student. And so I've made a lot of really close friends at Santa Clara University. Now I would say actually my closest friends are from Santa Clara University.
And when you're not at university, when you're not the job, what do you do to relax? I've seen videos of you doing martial art, piano playing, that sort of thing.
Outside of academics and work, I do a lot of things for fun. I like playing video games and chatting with friends. I played the piano and tennis. I used to do martial arts.
Have you personally, or maybe you as a family, reflected about why you are this gifted person? Is it something you think about, or is it just who you are?
I think it's just who I am. I think it's really just a genetic lottery. No matter how hard you try, I don't think it's possible to make a 5-year-old learn trigonometry or a 7-year-old learn calculus. I think it really was just the genetic lottery.
And I've read that you're quite keen on keeping up with current affairs and events and so on, and there's been a lot of concern recently, and we've heard President Biden talking about it, about artificial intelligence, AI, and its potential to transform our world, both for good and the bad. And I wondered if you had a chance to reflect on that.
Let me think. I think there's obviously been a lot of media hype, especially regarding ChatGPT. But I do believe that traditional companies that are desperately trying to capture some of the hype, and now new startups that really lack the viability but are seeking to capture some of the deep funding that's now available. But I think that in 12 to 18 months, we're going to see the market stabilize when it becomes clear. There's a very big gap between ease of use versus ease of creation. Something like ChatGPT is so intuitive that people think, oh, they can replicate it very easily. If you're not as technically knowledgeable, there's this illusion that it's easy, but it really isn't. It reminds me a lot of the crypto rush, where a lot of companies sought to integrate DeFi, the metaverse, and Web 3.0. It just shows that the hype doesn't always match the outcomes.
You're starting really early, graduated at 14, big job at 14. Is there a risk of burnout, I suppose, of peaking very early?
There's a very common concern that I'm missing out on some noble vision of childhood that exists outside of my ambitions and ability. And in what world does it make sense to hold back a person from fulfilling their personal ambitions and abilities? So I would say that I'm not worried about burnout or anything like that, because this is really my passion. I'm not doing this because anyone forced me to. It's something that I genuinely enjoy. And so I'm not worried about burnout.
James Copnell speaking to Karan Kwasi. And that's all from us for now. But there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Annie Smith, and the producer was David Lewis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Audrey.
And I'm Alan.
And between us, we host two podcasts from the BBC World Service.
All about Africa. So, Audrey, tell me about your new podcast, Focus on Africa.
It's every weekday afternoon, and Focus on Africa will explore three essential stories from across the continent, what you need to know about the stories that matter to Africans right now.
And every weekday morning, Africa Daily gives listeners a deep dive into a big question. It's one story from Africa for Africa.
So we'll be focusing on three essential stories to end your working day.
And I'm asking one big question for you to wake up to. Search for Africa Daily
and Focus on Africa
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.